programmes continue in just a few moments with science feedback, listeners' questions, comments and queries about World Service science programmes. That's in just a few moments.
The Essential Guide to the 21st Century is a documentary dedicated to the future. We try to guess what challenges lie ahead and how to deal with them.
To me, the cities right now have the creativity and the energy to solve the problems that they will be facing. And I think what's needed is a remixture of the factors that are scarce and the factors that are abundant. And to me, the scarce factors are financial factors and environmental factors. But what's abundant are human beings. There's a tremendous amount of underutilized human energy and will.
And it's not just the dynamic of the city that looks set to change. The internet is transforming the way we meet our ideal partners.
It's a very completely different dynamic of meeting a person, because you meet the inside of the person first, you meet the mind of the person first, and that's actually in the long term what probably maintains a relationship.
5 days a week, we bring you a half-hour documentary on anything and everything you need to know to survive the new millennium. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. The Essential Guide to the 21st Century. It's essential listening.
And the Survival Guide for the Millennium is coming soon. In fact, tomorrow at 18:30, or if it's more convenient, on Tuesday at 2:30 GMT. Now, BBC World Service, another edition of Science Feedback.
And welcome to, no, not Science in Action, but Science Feedback, the programme which gives you the chance to praise, to complain, and to ask all those burning questions, like...
What happened with the wonderful intro music of the programme Science in Action?
Hans Richter from Germany sent us this email, and I'm afraid the simple answer is... it's been axed. During the past year, we've had various long discussions in the science department and decided to abolish virtually all signature tunes for our science programmes. We'd used most of them for years and simply felt that they'd started to sound a bit dated and we needed a fresh approach, which gave us the opportunity to start programmes with mysterious noises, like this one.
In the last 10 years, an incredible discovery has been made in Antarctica. Deep underneath the ice, in one of the most remote parts of the continent, scientists have found a hidden lake. It's a discovery which has been made, like many in science...
by accident?
It's almost serendipity of an incredibly diverse suite of observations.
By the luck of the draw, by Murphy's Law, Lake Vostok was just barely observed.
Observed in the early 1970s when a plane was sent over eastern Antarctica to look under the ice using radar. As it flew over Russia's Vostok station, one of the most remote places on Earth, it picked up a signal for water under the ice.
That was Martin Redfern's discovery program on Lake Vostok, the vast freshwater lake buried deep under the Antarctic ice. Robert Eichelberger from California in the United States was obviously listening closely, not only to the crafty opening, but also to Martin's pronunciation.
I especially enjoyed the discovery program on Lake Vostok the other day. The program host really won my heart with his correct pronunciation of Antarctic. There is a C after the R.
Well, Martin Redfern is here in the studio with me now. Martin, there's a bit of the story to your pronunciation of Antarctic, isn't there?
Well, yes, like a lot of things in my life, it goes back to my mother, who I can remember listening to the radio, and each time somebody said Arctic, she would say, there's a C in it. Arctic is an abbreviation for an articulated lorry. Get it right. And that's something which never left me.
Now, why is Lake Vostok so interesting to scientists?
really, because it's been cut off from the rest of the world for such a long time, at least 40,000 years, possibly longer. It's deep under about 4 kilometres of thick ice, and there's almost certainly life of some sort in there, because there's life actually in the ice. There are bacteria trapped in the ice that's been buried there for 40,000 years, and it makes a wonderful model for space scientists who want to explore the world called Europa. That's one of the big moons of Jupiter. That also has a thick icy crust, probably even thicker, perhaps 100 kilometres thick. Lake Vostok will give them a good place to practice.
Well, I hope you're going to keep us posted. And thank you for your pronunciation of Arctic. And I've actually got a little bit of pronunciation that I'm quite proud of myself. And it was broadcast in Science in Action on the 12th of November. Greg Holmes referred to it in his email.
You reported on a newly invented molecule that can act like an element in a computer memory chip. I would like to locate a source for this story, complete with a spelling of the molecule.
I'm not going to spell the molecule's name now. We emailed Greg that information some time ago. But for those of you who missed it, here I am wrapping my tongue around a very, very long name.
Now here's Toby Murcott with this week's science news.
2'-amino-4-ethanol-phenol-4'-ethanol-phenol-5'-nitro-1-benzene-thiolate is the very long name for a newly invented chemical that could change the face of computing. A single molecule can act like... To be honest, it took me quite a bit of practice to be able to say that. So, as a test, we decided to see how difficult chemical names really are by asking some people on the streets of London to have a go.
So, what do you want me to read? Everything
that,
here.
That word there.
The ball thing.
Yeah.
2'-amino-4-ethyl-phenyl-4'-ethyl-ethanyl-phenyl-5'-nitro-1-benzene... All right. Benzene thiolate or something.
Oh, you're joking, aren't you?
2'-amino-4-ethanyl-blend.
Oh, you see, it's not so easy, though maybe not that useful either. Perhaps we spent too much time on practicing pronunciation and not enough checking our geographical facts. Cy Bain sent us an email in which he picked up on a particularly embarrassing error in this program item.
In the aftermath of last Tuesday's devastating earthquake in the Turkish city of Izmit, geologists are warning that the capital, Istanbul, is now vulnerable to a similar disaster. A series of earthquakes have occurred...
And this is what's wrong with it.
On August the 27th, in the 1405 GMT broadcast of Science in Action, in the piece on the Turkey earthquake, I was astonished to hear Istanbul called the capital of Turkey.
Of course Istanbul isn't the capital of Turkey, it's Ankara. So, many apologies for the mistake, and I hope you believe us when we say that we're all well-travelled globetrotters with some knowledge in geography. It just doesn't always show.
Istanbul, Constantinople, now it's Istanbul.
It's not Constantinople.
Another program that always attracts lots of letters and emails is Health Matters. And one of the items that many of you commented on was our report on how to stop smoking on the 16th of August. Barbara Myers talked to Neil Casey, a psychologist who classifies himself as a heavy ex-smoker. And he'd written a book full of useful tips on how to kick the habit.
Well, one of the things I developed was basically a set of cue cards, if you like, each one containing a very simple, straightforward, in just a few words, message. It could be a fact, it could have been a question, it could be a medical statistic, underlining the basic reasons for stopping smoking that we could then put on cards. And gradually these grew, and eventually it seemed the logical thing to do was to actually turn these into a book of some sort.
So these are your little dog-eared cards that you used, your cue cards.
That's
to
right.
Remind yourselves of some of the messages, and you turn
mm-hmm.
them into a book, which is called The Little Book of Not Smoking. Here
That's
are
right.
some of the top tips from it.
Heart and lungs feel okay, smokers. Even if your heart and lungs aren't seriously injured now, there are plenty of other cancers you can get, including cancer of the esophagus, pancreas, bladder, and mouth. Some of these cancers are inoperable.
Are you dating a non-smoker? To a non-smoker, close physical contact with a smoker can be unpleasant, to say the least. Smokers are often unaware just how bad cigarettes really smell.
And if this doesn't make you think twice about lighting up your next cigarette, then maybe the story of our listener, T.H. Bomer from South Africa, will. He was a heavy smoker, and although he suffered from asthma, he kept on smoking 30 cigarettes a day until doctors discovered a light patch on an X-ray of his chest. Scared at the prospect of lung cancer, he decided to quit.
I stopped smoking about 3 years ago, after smoking cigarettes for 20 years, and I've never felt like starting again. I simply just made up my mind to quit. Smoke-free zones help a lot in giving up smoking. I also think that being on holiday, away from the stress of work, also helps. The main trick, however, is just to decide to stop, one day at a time, for the rest of your life. However, I still remain a coffee-olic.
Well, Mr. Bomer, one way to get rid of your coffee addiction might be to try some of the brown, murky stuff sitting in a cup in front of me at the moment, something my producer seems to believe is coffee. Moving on.
My name is Kevin Cassidy. I'm working here in Kitui through voluntary services overseas, St. Michael's Vocational Training to deaf students who have completed their primary education. Their natural language is sign language, which unfortunately here in Kenya is not regarded as a proper language and is looked upon as an inferior substitute to spoken English. So naturally, I was very interested in a Science in Action program broadcast on Friday the 13th of August. There was a report by Molly Bentley from America about teaching sign language to hearing children and how it increased their spoken language vocabulary. Is there any chance of getting a contact address where I can find out more about this project?
Yes, but before I give you the address, here's a reminder of that report that caught your attention.
What is that down there? It's your combine. That's right. What does the combine do?
None.
Meredith Layton was a speech pathologist in Memphis when her son Beau was born. Beau wasn't hearing impaired like many of her students, but as he approached 8 months old, he struggled like any child to express himself.
Tell her what your name is. Beau. That's right. How do you spell your name?
Beau.
He was very frustrated, as was I, that he could not communicate exactly what he wanted to say, and it was very obvious to me that he had plenty to say, and it just occurred to me when he was about 8 months old that instead of only thinking of sign language in a very narrow way, to use it for children with special needs, that it would transfer beautifully to my own child.
So Meredith taught Beau to sign. Then she met psychologist Linda Accredolo at the University of California, who studies how sign language affects brain development. Frustrated infants who can't yet speak will push and shove and cry to get their point across. But Professor Accredolo found that sign language helps even children with normal hearing and gets them talking sooner.
Babies who sign do learn to speak earlier, and we think there are a number of reasons for that. One is that they find communicating so much fun, they're anxious to move on to the next step, and words are the next step. Second reason is that when a baby uses baby sign, say, name something that they see, an airplane in the sky or something, when they do that, the parents then respond by flooding that child with appropriate words. You're right, that is an airplane. I didn't even see it. Oh, yes, look, and there it goes in the clouds. So the child is drawing the parent's attention to the topic they're interested in, and then the parent provides the language for the child.
Linda Accredolo, concluding that report by Molly Bentley. And you can contact the project at
Psychology Department, University of California at Davis, number 1 Shields Avenue, Davis, California 95616, USA.
Science Feedback gets all sorts of letters, some of which contain suggestions, like this one from Ms. Ong Chen Siul from Singapore.
Perhaps Health Matters could in future include information on topics like protein and its sources, fibre, vitamins and so forth. I think a great number of people still do not know the value of these.
Well, joining me now is Mick Delap, World Service Commissioner for Science. Mick, are you going to take up the challenge? Will we hear more about diet?
I think we will, yes. I mean, obviously it's crucial to health. It has interesting scientific elements to it as well. And from April, when we do slightly rearrange the schedule, there will be a Health Matters late evening program which plans to cover fitness, including diet. So we will focus much more in on single issues and give a whole programme to them. There will be ongoing news coverage just to catch any new developments, so that if there is a big argument about genetically modified food, about some other aspect of food safety, some other aspect of food additives in sport, I mean, we've got the Olympics coming up, there's bound to be a lot about what damage they do as against the benefit they provide and so on. We'll pick those up as current issues as they come along, but we also want to be able to focus in on on important issues, and food will certainly be one of them.
So clearly we've got a lot to listen out for come April, you said.
Come April, and we think it'll be a much easier way of catching, making a date with the programme you want.
Well, there you go, you heard it here first. We will have more on this. So we've got plenty to look forward to in the year 2000. I hope you enjoy listening to the new health magazines, and of course all the rest of the science programmes on the BBC World Service. And please, keep the letters and emails coming.
Science Feedback was presented by Toby Murcott and produced by Tristan Citrashek. And if you want to send letters to Science Feedback, the address is Science Feedback, Bush House, London. Well, on BBC World Service, here's Patrick Condren with this week's Right On.
Hello and welcome along to a very special New Year edition of Right On. Joining me in the studio is the boss of the World Service, Mark Byford, to answer the questions you've all been sending in over the past few weeks. Mark, thanks for your time today. I know you're a very busy bloke.
Yes, I am, but it's always a great pleasure to see you and to be able to talk and engage with listeners across the world.
Excellent. In that case, we'll crack on.
From Michelle Daly, presently in Hong Kong. Dear Mark Byford, can you give a logical explanation for the World Service's compulsion to change its programming times every 6 months? I can only consider it a compulsion, a need for the sake of my sanity to know why you have to do this. I know that in life one gains and loses, but this most recent change has caused me to lose Alistair Cook, Discovery, Science in Action, as well as the other science broadcasts and a few other favourites, thus tipping the balance most unfavourably. Perhaps you're trying to distribute the loss evenly around the world, so you present these on different days and at different times during the different seasons, thus spreading the misery. Somehow, though, this latest change has been much harder for me to adapt to than almost all previous ones. Unfortunately, I just can't change my obligations to suit my BBC listening, however much I might want to. On the other hand, the previous 6 months' programming enabled me to listen to most of what I like. Part of the problem has been the introduction of The World Today, which eliminates every shorter broadcast that used to fill the morning spots and enable me to catch up on many favourites I haven't been able to catch earlier.
Mark, I know April will herald a big change at the World Service. Can you give us an overview?
Well, the secret of changing radio, of course, is that the listeners don't really realise that there is big change around, or if there is change, it's better than what they had before. And the changes and developments that we're taking forward are based on talking to listeners across the world on what they really would value. At the moment, we have a core mixed schedule of the World Service that is varied across different regions of the world three times. For the Americas and Europe, for Africa, and for Asia and Pacific. We still act global, but we want to increasingly be able to tailor our mixed schedule offer of news and general programs, whether it's drama and features, to not only the clock of any given area of the world, but the way that people use radio. So we're now going to move forward to eight different schedules streams across the world, which increasingly will be tailored to how our listeners are, if you like, leading their lives. So there'll be a different programme schedule for different parts of the world. But wherever you are, it will be driven by having a core news and current affairs programme sequence at breakfast, at lunchtime, and what we call drive time, tea time, you know, early evening, and definite times of the day for programmes that are highly valued within our broad agenda of features, drama, reading, sport, business, so that the listener, if you like, knows where they are with the schedule, which of course is very important, are familiar with it, but it's also matched to how they lead their lives and the kind of radio programming that they're wanting. It's not revolution, to be honest. The revolution, if any, is in the fact that we're producing more scheduled streams, but to any listener across the world, they will still have their programmes that I hope they love and adore at the times they want, but it'll be a clearer schedule.
I can already hear the scratching of pen on paper. People saying, it's another change. We've just been through 2 or 3 years of schedule changes at the World Service. Why are they inflicting this on us?
To make it better. And to make sure that our position as the lead international radio broadcaster across the world is maintained, if not enhanced.
Let's move on to another listener, Simon Cooper in Spain.
Who is the World Service for? It can't possibly be me, an Englishman under 60 forced to listen to it most days. Do you deliberately set out to create a Groundhog Day effect by repeating programmes over and over? I switch on at 8 a.m. London time and switch off about 11 p.m. London time, and it seems to me that throughout the course of a couple of days, I hear your programmes repeated twice and even thrice in some cases. Are programme makers at the World Service told to be politically correct? This would explain the large number of interviewees who can hardly speak English.
Mark, we get a lot of letters at Right On from expatriate Brits who seem to think the World Service is exclusively theirs. Is it?
No.
Why not?
They're a valued part of our worldwide audience, but your words, are they exclusively the audience? Not at all. They're a part of the audience and, of course, a much valued one. But we are a world broadcaster to a world audience.
From Ruth Heifetz in Haifa. Since you're having Mark Byford along, can you pass on some remarks, please? The schedule in general is the best we've had for years. Most programmes are placed for our region. What isn't so good is the programme promotions that are constantly being aired. They don't add anything to the overall product. The music in the world today is unbearable.
Ruth is one of any number of correspondents, regular correspondents to Write On, bemoaning the use of promotions, and particularly the jingle music in the world today. Why do we need promotions and jingles?
Well, firstly, I'm delighted that she says that the schedule is the best that we've had for years.
I thought you'd pick up on that.
Well, we have to have a balance on all World Service programmes, Patrick. But cross-promotion is vital. I get just as many letters saying, I wish you could point out where programmes are in the day so that I can then get hold of them. One of the things I think in the last year that we've improved on quite dramatically is able to guide listeners to where programmes are across the schedule. Listeners are never listening to just one programme and then never coming back. They want to know. And with the World Service, where it is difficult to explain the daily schedule through newspapers, magazines, etc., often it's the listener only gets to know the programme range through the radio station itself. We have to use cross-promotion effectively and carefully. You know, people don't like trail after trail after trail. On the other hand, they do want to know what's coming up and what's available. The World Today music, well, I'd be telling fibs. I'd be telling fibs if I said everybody said it was wonderful. We're reviewing it, and we'll look as part of our developments for next April of improving that particular aspect of the programme such that I hope we get more letters saying it's now an improvement rather than the other way.
From Bill McGee. I'm on US Pacific time, so I don't get anything to listen to on Saturday until the middle of the afternoon, since you have nothing but sport and pop music with short news breaks for 6 hours. Please let me know when you are going to find someone with at least half a brain to do your scheduling. Another point. I've always greatly admired World Service features, but recently, on looking through On Air magazine, I've noticed that the number is declining. Is this an example of more dumbing down?
Bill takes us back to scheduling and talks about, as well, the percentage of feature programs, of non-news programs on the World Service. Is the ratio of news to features becoming heavily weighted in favour of news?
No. It's just that we may, in our on-air magazine, as Bill points out, classify our programming in a different manner. For instance,
so what's the difference between classification and actual programming?
Let me give you an example. Christianity at the Crossroads, our landmark religious program series, is now within religion in the on-air magazine, whereas before it could have well been within features. But if you look at the
overall, there's still two non-news.
They are, but to respond to Bill's point, he's saying because
features within the on-air magazine look lower in number, is it therefore a news-dominant schedule? It's not at all. It's just that as well as what we would describe as features, we have a range of programmings that's very much driven by genre, whether it's drama, whether it's readings, whether it's sport, or whether it's religion. And our commitment to that broad range of programming, with a spine, absolutely, a backbone of news and current affairs, will be retained.
That's in April. You can guarantee that the ratio will, yes, the news to non-news will remain the same.
Yeah, I will certainly guarantee that the World Service will be a broad range of programmes across the schedule, with a backbone, obviously, of news and current affairs, because that's what the audience admire and want from the World Service, as well as different programmes, whether it's education, as I say, sport and features, that make up this really unique and distinctive schedule. Yes, I guarantee that. What I also would say to Bill is, he is right that, you know, The Edge is a programme for young listeners on a Saturday morning, followed by sport. And if you're not a person that want programming for young listeners with music, and then you don't like sport, on a Saturday, there may not be as much as on the other days of the week that appeal to you. What we're trying to be, though, is appealing to all. And Saturday mornings is a great time to capture younger people who are back from school or college to listen. And sport, my goodness, Bill, imagine the flow of letters that we would have if we took off sport on Saturday afternoons, the traditional time.
From Dudley K. Nylander, Freetown, Sierra Leone. Many people in Freetown are up in arms because the station that was supposed to be relaying World Service programmes 24 hours a day suddenly announced it was going to resume local broadcasting. As a result, World Service programmes are now only broadcast part of the day. It's all very frustrating, as it's difficult to start grappling with shortwave once you are used to FM. Anyway, the feeling is that the BBC could solve the problem by opening a station that relays World Service programmes 24 hours a day. Could you let us know Mr. Byford's reaction to our predicament?
Mark, is there anything you can say to Dudley to relieve his pain?
Well, I appreciate that Dudley listening in Freetown will want the World Service 24 hours a day on FM. And we've had a relationship with a local station, The Voice of the Handicapped, for some time, where initially that relationship meant that we were on for part of the day in Freetown on FM, and Voice of the Handicapped were providing their own local programming. It then, for a period, happened such that the World Service was broadcasting its programmes 24 hours of the day, but the Voice of the Handicapped have brought more of their local programming back. And this is a rebroadcasting partnership. So we're getting our own programmes through FM in Freetown, but also within a station that's also providing its own local programming as well. We would like to be on FM 24 hours of the day in Sierra Leone. And indeed, we're exploring that opportunity.
That brings us to the point that the World Service is also available on the internet and via satellite technology. And it's technology that the World Service is increasingly exploring to get its product out there. Is there a danger that the World Service will eventually ignore places like Africa because they're poor and they can't afford the technology, they can't afford the computers and the satellite technology?
Well, I suppose there is a potential danger, but my goodness me, I hope never ever does that happen. And our strategy is exactly the opposite. The World Service has been in existence for more than 60 years, and for nearly all of that time has been a core shortwave broadcaster across the world. Over the last 10 years, as markets have deregulated and FM and medium wave becomes increasingly available in major conurbations across the world, the World Service has wanted to complement, not replace, complement its shortwave offer by offering a better quality sound on FM. And we're now on 102 capital cities of the world. 80% of the World Service's audience of 143 million listeners is through shortwave. And even in 5 years' time, we reckon it will still be at least 60%. But different audience groups are using the World Service in different ways. And we recognise that our core audience is using the World Service through shortwave. And we're absolutely committed to still ensuring that we reach the audiences we want to reach. But we've got to be alert to the new technologies as well and be present on them too.
if we're to hold our lead position.
Mark, many thanks for your time today. We've covered a lot of territory and hopefully answered some of the issues of our global audience. And that's it from me. This is my last ride on. It's been fun, but fatherhood beckons and I'm going to be busy changing nappies for the foreseeable future. Thanks for all your letters over the past couple of years. Dilly Barlow is along next week.
And letters meant for broadcast on the World Service Letters programme should be sent to Write On, BBC World Service, Bush House, London, WC2B, 4PH. The email address is writeon@bbc.co.uk. The fax number is 44 for Britain, then 171-436-2800. Right On was presented by Patrick Condren and is a testbed production. Coming next, The World Today. Half an hour of news with comment and analysis on the breaking stories of the day in half a minute. Well, just looking ahead, following The World Today, in half an hour we have the French composer and conductor Pierre Boulez reflecting on the current and future state of classical music in a music review special, which is presented by Anthony Burton at 1:30 Greenwich Mean Time.